the true victor of the war. Stalin enjoyed the prestige of a world conqueror, yet the disparity between his political power and his personal exhaustion made him feel vulnerable. But Stalin's courtiers noticed that his triumph had turned his head. "He became conceited," said Molotov. "Not a good feature in a statesman. His prestige was so great that he was absolute in all matters. His mere words were taken as party orders and instantly obeyed. Yet he now ruled in a very different way. He stepped aside from direct ruling," said one of his officials, "and assumed the Olympian mantle of a paramount leader. He used secrecy, caprice, and obscurity to maintain his mastery over his younger, stronger, ambitious magnates. He dominated his entourage by mystery." "He never gave direct orders," wrote his Georgian boss, Chapviani, "so you had to make your own conclusions." Stalin understood that it doesn't matter what part of the pool you throw a stone, the ripples will spread. He once showed his Abkhazian leader, Mogiladze, his beloved lemon trees again and again, until the apparatchik finally understood and declared that Abkhazia would produce lemons for the whole USSR. "Now you've got it," smiled Stalin. Unless he was in a temper, he usually ended his orders, "Do as you wish," but no one mistook his meaning. If, on the other hand, he gave a direct order, writing, "I don't think my reasons need to be discussed, they are perfectly clear," or simply shouted his wishes, he was instantly obeyed. The mere mention of instancia justified any act of barbarism. However, the generalissimo was also weaker and older than before. Shortly before the victory parade, Stalin had experienced some sort of heart attack, or what Svetlana called a minor stroke, hardly surprising given the strain of warlordism on his remarkably durable metabolism. Stalin already suffered from arthritis, but it was the hardening of his arteries, arteriosclerosis, that reduced the flow of blood to the brain and could only impair his mental faculties. Usually calm, reserved, and patient, he often exploded instantly and made irrelevant and wrong decisions. Khrushchev said, after the war, he wasn't quite right in the head. He remained a supreme manipulator, though it is likely that the arteriosclerosis exacerbated his existing tempers, depression, and paranoia. "He was very jittery," said Molotov. "His last years were the most dangerous. He swung to extremes. He was jealous of Molotov and Zhukov's prestige, suspicious of Beria's power, and disgusted by the soft smugness of his magnates. Even when he was ill and old, he was never happier than when he was orchestrating a struggle. It was his gift, his natural state." More than ever, his courtiers had to know how to handle him, but first they had to survive his nocturnal routine. Typically, the magnates met at the little corner, after which the generalissimo always proposed a movie. He led his guests along the red and blue carpeted corridors to the luxurious cinema on the second floor of the great Kremlin palace. Beria, Molotov, Mikoyan, and Malenkov remained his constant companions, but his proconsuls in Finland and Ukraine, Zhdanov and Khrushchev, often visited too. Then there was the whole new court of European vassals. His favorites were the Polish leader, Bolesław Bierut, polite, well-dressed, well-mannered, a perfect gentleman with women, but a ruthless Stalinist with a fanatical faith in the dogma. His deputy, Jakob Berman, the Czech president, Klement Gottwald, Hungary's Matvej Rakosi, each of them was honored to come to Moscow to pay homage and receive Stalin's sacerdotal wisdom and imperial commands. The prouder Yugoslavs, Marshal Tito and Milovan Djilash, were less liked. The walk to the luxurious cinema took a few minutes. The sight of the generalissimo and his guards approaching was a terrifying one for any young official who happened to be walking along these corridors. Anyone who saw him approaching had to stand back against the wall and show their hands. The plain-clothed guards walked 25 steps in front and 2 meters behind Stalin, while the uniformed guards followed him with their eyes. The Politburo would arrive first, taking their seats, but leaving the front row empty for Stalin. They were met by the Minister of Cinema, Ivan Bolshakov, a vital but comical presence in the entourage. Bolshakov was terrified of Stalin, since his two predecessors had been shot. As Stalin got older, the cinema became an obsessive ritual, as well as an aid and venue for governing. Bolshakov's big decision was which film to show. This he judged by trying to guess Stalin's mood. He observed the leader's gait, intonation of voice, and sometimes, if he was lucky, Vlasik or Paskryobyshev gave him a clue. If Stalin was in a bad mood, Bolshakov knew it was not a good idea to show a new movie. Stalin was a creature of habit. He loved his old favorites from the 30s like Volga Volga, or foreign films such as In Old Chicago, Mission to Moscow, the comedy It Happened One Night, or any Charlie Chaplin. Stalin ordered Bolshakov to interpret the foreign films. Yet Bolshakov spoke only pidgin English. He therefore spent much of his time preparing for these midnight sessions by having interpreters go over the film for him and then learning the script. This was a challenge because at any time he had hundreds of films available. Thus, his interpretation was usually absurdly obvious and very late, long after it was clear what the character had already said. The Politburo laughed and teased the flustered Bolshakov. Stalin, who evidently enjoyed this farce, never demanded a proper interpreter. Stalin now possessed a new library of American, English, and German films that had, until recently, been the property of Goebbels. If Stalin was in a bad mood, one of the Goebbels films would please him. He liked detective films, westerns, gangster films, and he enjoyed fights. He banned any hint of sexuality. When Bolshakov once showed him a slightly risque scene involving a naked girl, he banged the table and said, "Are you making a brothel here, Bolshakov?" Then he walked out, followed by the Politburo, leaving poor Bolshakov awaiting arrest. From then on, he cut even the slightest glimpse of nudity. Bolshakov made notes of all Stalin's critiques. In the morning, he called the directors or scriptwriters and passed on the comments without specifying their source, but no doubt his quivering voice and breathless awe made it obvious. Stalin imposed politics on film, but also film on reality. Zhilash noticed how he seemed to mix up what was going on, in the manner of an uneducated man who mistakes artistic reality for actuality. He reveled in films about murdering friends and associates. This was depressing for his comrades, who could not forget that, as Khrushchev put it, "we were temporary people." Stalin's isolated position made these films increasingly powerful. After the war, Stalin wanted to impose taxes on the peasants, even though the countryside was stricken with famine. The whole Politburo sensibly opposed this, which angered Stalin. He was convinced the peasants could afford it. He pointed to the plenty shown in his propaganda movies, allowing him to ignore the starvation. After seeing the movie on Catherine the Great's admiral, Ushakov, Stalin became obsessed with building a powerful fleet, quoting a character in the film who says, "Land forces are a sword in one hand, sea forces a sword in the other." He often insisted on seeing two movies in a row, and afterwards, around 2 a.m., would say, "Let's go and get something to eat," adding, "if you have time," as if there was any choice in the matter. The cars would then be summoned to take them to Kuntsevo. The guests had to prepare for the dinners, which lasted until dawn, resting in the afternoon because those sleeping at Stalin's table came to a bad end, said Khrushchev. Stalin always sat to the left of the head of the table with Beria at the end, and the guest of honor on Stalin's left. As soon as they sat down, the drinking started. At first it was civilized with a few bottles of wine, sometimes weak Georgian juice and some champagne, which Stalin greatly enjoyed. Mikoyan and Beria used to bring wine. "Being Caucasian, you understand wine better than the others. Try it," Stalin would say. It was soon clear that he was testing the wines for poison, so they stopped bringing it. Stalin provided his own wine and genially opened the bottles himself. As the evening went on, the toasts of vodka, pepper vodka and brandy became more insistent until even these iron-bellied drinkers were blind drunk. After Stalin's binges in 1944 and 5, Professor Vinogradov warned him to cut back on the drinking, and he started to water down his drinks. forcing his tough comrades to lose control of themselves became his sport, and a measure of dominance. Sometimes the drinking at these bacchanals was so intense that the potentates, like aging, bloated students, staggered out to vomit, soiled themselves, or simply had to be borne home by their guards. Stalin praised Molotov's capacity, but sometimes even he became drunk. Baskryobyshev was the most prolific vomiter. Khrushchev was a prodigious drinker, as eager to please Stalin as Beria. He sometimes became so inebriated that Beria took him home and put him to bed, which he promptly wet. Zhdanov and Shcherbakov could not control their drinking, and became alcoholics. The latter died of the disease in May 1945, but Zhdanov tried to fight it. Bulganin was practically an alcoholic. Malenkov just became more bloated. Stalin's Middle European vassals coped no better. Gottwald was so inebriated that he requested that Czechoslovakia join the USSR. His wife, who came with him, heroically volunteered, "Allow me, Comrade Stalin, to drink in my husband's place. I'll drink for us both." Rakosi foolishly told Beria that the Soviets were drunkards. "We'll see about that," scoffed Stalin, who joined Beria in pumping the Hungarian with drink. The standard of drunken horseplay was not much better than a university or fraternity house. Khrushchev and Paskryobyshev drunkenly pushed Kulik into the pond. They knew Stalin had lost respect for the buffoon. Kulik, famously strong, jumped out soaking, and chased Paskryobyshev, who hid in the bushes. Beria warned, "If anyone tried something like that on me, I'd make mincemeat of them." Paskryobyshev was regularly pushed in until the guards became so worried that a drunken magnate would drown that they discreetly drained the pond. This infantile behavior delighted Stalin. "You're like little children." Supreme power is often the supreme power to bore. The old generalissimo had become repetitive, irritable, and forgetful. Beria and Khrushchev knew by heart Stalin's exaggerated exploits in exile, his trips to London and Vienna, his childhood beatings at the hands of his father. Stalin dwelt more and more on the curious happiness of his exile, perhaps the only true happiness he had known. Each magnate policed the others, constantly vigilant to protect their interests and avoid provoking the old tiger. It became increasingly difficult to discuss real politics. When Mikoyan told Stalin there was a food shortage, Stalin became anxious and, while feasting on the myriad dishes, kept asking, "Why is there no food?" "Ask Malenkov. He's in charge of agriculture," replied Mikoyan. At that moment, the heels of both Beria and Malenkov landed hard on Mikoyan's foot under the table. "What's the use of it?" Beria and Malenkov attacked Mikoyan afterwards. "It just irritates Stalin. He begins to attack one or other of us. He should be told only what he likes to hear to create a nice atmosphere, not to spoil the dinner." When foreigners were absent, the fate of men was often decided. Yet Stalin talked about their acquaintances murdered during the 30s with the calm detachment of a historian, showing neither sorrow nor rage, just a light humor. Once he wandered up to one of his marshals, who had been arrested and released. "I heard you were recently in confinement." "Yes, Comrade Stalin, I was, but they figured out my case and released me. But how many good and remarkable people perished there?" "Yes," mused Stalin thoughtfully, "we've lost a lot of good and remarkable people." Then he walked out of the room into the garden. The courtiers turned on the marshal. "What did you say to Comrade Stalin?" demanded Malenkov, who always behaved like the school prefect. "Why?" Then Stalin reappeared, holding a bouquet of roses, which he presented to the marshal as a weird sort of apology. The magnates studied Stalin like zoologists to read his moods, win his favor, and survive. The key was to understand Stalin's unique blend of supersensitive discomfiture and world historical arrogance, his longing to be liked, and his heartless cruelty. It was vital not to make him anxious. There were certain key rules, the first of which was to look Stalin straight in the eyes. Otherwise, he asked, "Why don't you look me in the eye today?" but it was dangerous to look into his eyes too much. Gomułka, one of the Polish leaders, took notes and showed respect, but his intensity made Stalin nervous. "What kind of fellow's Gomułka? He sits there all the time looking into my eyes as though searching for something. Perhaps he was an agent." The visitor had to maintain calm at all times. Panic alarmed Stalin. Visitors must show respect by taking notes, like Malenkov, but not too frantically, like Gomułka. Yet firmness and humour with Stalin usually worked well. He admired and protected Zhukov and Khrushchev for their strong views. The potentates could never meet in private. Danger lurked in friends and friendship. An innocent meeting could end tragically. Stalin relished their mutual hatreds. Beria, Malenkov loathed Zhdanov and Voznesensky. Mikoyan hated Beria. Bulganin hated Malenkov. Their homes were all now bugged. But Beria claimed that he deliberately criticized policy at home because otherwise Stalin would become suspicious. Their importance depended not on seniority, but purely on their relationships with Stalin. Beria said the only way to survive was always to strike first. It was sensible to denounce your fellow bosses at all times, or as Vyshinsky put it, keep people on edge. When Molotov made a mistake, Vyshinsky reveled in it. But the denouncers were on edge too. When a 10-page denunciation of Vyshinsky was received, Stalin decided to do nothing with it. But, as always, he informed the victim. Later that day, Vyshinsky was found staring into oblivion. "I'm only theoretically alive. I just got through the day. Well, at least that's something, thank God." After dinner, Stalin played the gramophone. He relished his comic records, including one of the warbling of a singer accompanied by the yowling and barking of dogs, which always made him laugh. "Well, it's still clever, devilishly clever." He marked the records with his comments. "Very good." Stalin urged his grandees to dance, but this was no longer the exhilarating whirligig of Voroshilov and Mikoyan tripping the light fantastic. This, too, had become a test of power and strength. Stalin himself shuffled around with his arms spread out in Georgian style, though he had a sense of rhythm. "Comrade Yosef Vissarionovich, how strong you are," chirped the Politburo. Then he stopped and became gloomy. "Oh no, I won't live long. The physiological laws are having their way." "No, no," Molotov chorused. "Comrade Yosef Vissarionovich, we need you. You still have a long life ahead of you." "Age has crept up on me, and I'm already an old man."
"Nonsense, you look fine. You're holding up marvelously."
Once, when Tito was present, Stalin waved away these reassurances and looked at his guest, whose assassination he would later order. "Tito should take care of himself in case anything happens to him, because I won't live long." Then, in a bizarre demonstration of his virility, Stalin declared, "There's still strength in me." He lifted Tito 3 times off the floor in time to the Russian folk song on the gramophone. Ever since the 30s, Molotov's party trick had been gravely slow dancing with other men, to the guffaws of Stalin. Polish security boss Berman was amazed when the Soviet foreign minister asked him to waltz. "I just moved my feet in rhythm, like the woman," said Berman. Molotov led. "He wasn't a bad dancer. I tried to keep in step, but what I did resembled clowning more than dancing. It was pleasant, but with an inner tension." Stalin watched from the gramophone, grinning roguishly as Molotov and Berman glided across the floor. It was Stalin who really had fun. "For us," said Berman, "these dancing sessions were a good opportunity to whisper to each other things that couldn't be said out loud." Molotov warned Berman about being infiltrated by various hostile organizations, a warning prearranged with Stalin. When Zhdanov moved to the piano, they sang religious hymns, white anthems and Georgian folk songs. The haunting nostalgia of these songs from those lost worlds of seminaries and church choirs was instantly shattered by Stalin's explosions of anger and contempt. "A reasonable interrogator," said Khrushchev, "would not behave with a hardened criminal the way Stalin behaved with friends at his table." At about 5 a.m, Stalin dismissed his exhausted comrades, who were often so drunk they could hardly move. The guards ordered the cars round to the front, and the chauffeurs dragged away their charges. On the way home, Khrushchev and Bulganin lay back, relieved to have survived. "One never knows," whispered Bulganin, "if one's going home or to prison." The guards locked the doors of the dacha and retired to their guardhouse. Stalin lay on one of his divans and started to read. Finally, drink and exhaustion soothed this obsessional dynamo. He slept. His bodyguards noted the light go out in Stalin's quarters. No movement.